Okay. Let me start off over again. My name is Tom Hoover. I'm the Instructional Technology Director at Pepperdine University. I want to introduce Kim Carey, Dr. Kim Carey. He's our Chief Security Officer for the university. He's going to talk about network control strategy today and what we've implemented at Pepperdine University. So after, please fill out the surveys that are, I believe, are in the back, and I'll let Kim take it away.
Thanks very much, Tom. Tom's group, our client services folks, we're a big partner in this. I think that we're very proud of having made a good success of distributing network control on all our end user networks. We want to take some of the lessons that we've learned from that in a very general way and share them with you and hopefully allow you to utilize the appropriate ones of those from here as you build your own network control strategy. First of all, briefly, before we get into what we did, I'd like to ask you all a little bit about your networks. And if we can just do a quick show of hands, I won't keep your hands in the air too long, but we'll go through about four things. Could I ask you all to raise your hand if you have some form of network access control on your network now? So about half the group. And if you've got it now, could you raise your hand if you are looking to replace it? Okay, there's about three people here that are looking to replace it. We're talking about network access control, but we're really, when we talk about network control, we're really talking about controlling workstations and computers and devices that belong to people. And I'd like to get an idea real briefly of what those of you who are doing network access control are, what people groups, what roles you're applying that to. How many of you are applying this to guests that visit your campus? Looks like about 10. And how many are applying it to students? A few more. And how many of you are applying it to faculty and staff areas? Okay, a different group, but still about 10. So we've got about, I think, 30-something people in the room. So about a third. All right. Well, let me give you some relevant facts about our university. We have about 7,700 students. I'd say there's about 2,400 of these that are residents, either grad or undergrad. We have about 3,200 fully employed graduate students, and these folks are mostly on our graduate campuses. We have five campuses in Southern California that are connected on a wide area network with high-speed links. Our main campus is in Malibu. It has about 50 buildings that have both wired and wireless networks spread out of a small portion of our 830 acres. Our four graduate campuses are in office towers, either a single floor, in most cases multiple floors, of an office tower that's out in the city somewhere. And those things are in our IP address space and are under control of our network access system. The project that we're going to talk about had its genesis in 2008, and this is what we knew about our network in 2008. By analyzing the DHCP leases, we could tell that we had about 9,000 active devices on our network in any given week. And by looking at spreadsheets that had been created for the installation or maintenance of switches and wireless access points, we knew that we had about 450 wireless access points and 400 network switches. We are primarily a Cisco shop, FYI, but a lot of the access points were old Lucent or Avaya, older Cisco, and by the time we got to this product, we also had a mix of Xeris and Aruba. So our switches were fairly homogeneous, although some of them were really old, and as far as vendor is concerned, and our access points were kind of hybrid and all over the map. Well, we had two kinds of network security problems as we looked at it in 2008. We had an acute problem, and we had some chronic problems. Our acute problem was actually had a great genesis. Our new CIO in 2007, Tim Chester, Dr. Tim Chester, had secured funding to put wireless in our dorms. So finally, our students who had been bringing in routers and hooking them up to the network backwards and stuff would have a university wireless network to use in their residences. And so that was really neat. But that turned out to be a problem because we needed to replace our 2003 wireless access control for a number of reasons. Our wireless networks were not performing well on our end user satisfaction surveys, and this wireless access control, we felt, contributed to part of that low score. One reason was it was a true hotspot type system, i.e., every time you went to use the network, the wireless network, you had to sign in. So if you were a professor and you went to lunch, came back, wanted to go to class, you had to sign back in, surprise, at the start of your class. Or if you were a student and coming and going, every time you closed your computer and were gone for like 90 minutes, you had to sign back in. And people didn't like that. The other thing is we were spending a considerable amount of money in 2007, 2008 on increasing the bandwidth to campus and on facilities like better networks, like these wireless networks that we were putting in. And this device that we had for wireless access control had all the traffic routed through it. And as such, as more and more people were getting on wireless, it began to limit their throughput. For all of us in information security and the network side, we felt that the reporting from this device was awkward. It was very hard to, you could do it, you could find out which IP belonged to which person, but it was awkward, and blocking and unblocking computers on this device was manual, and so we pretty much resorted to blocking people at the router that had malware-infected computers. And also, we couldn't extend it if we wanted to because the vendor had just gone bankrupt. So when we got this funding, we got an acute network problem to go with our chronic network problems. We had no wired access control at all. Anything that plugs in gets full access. Our network was put together kind of organically, like a lot of things in Southern California. But in our case, what this meant was that as buildings got funding to be networked, they were. And all the VLANs were geographical. They were not role-based, in part because that wasn't the thought at the time in the early 90s when they were putting these things in, that you might have to separate users according to their role. But also, our buildings are very mixed use. Even in our dorms, we have staff offices. You might have execs and printers and staffers and faculty and students and computer labs all in the same building. And we have two network techs for the entire campus, and the idea of switching ports by role manually just did not occur to them because it wouldn't have been very practical. As such, also, we had no practical way to identify a user. You could try to cross-correlate with what IP had logged into what system and figure out what user ID was using that IP, but that wasn't very practical. So we basically, all our network users, particularly on the wire side, were anonymous. The other big problem, and this was showing up in our user satisfaction surveys, was blocks were indistinguishable from problems with your network card. So if you had a spam bot and our homegrown network-based anomaly detection system detected that, it would go out and automatically block you, probably at the router. And then your computer would stop talking, talking to what you wanted to talk to. It could still infect the other people on your subnet because you were blocked at the router. But basically, people would fiddle with their computer. They'd talk to their neighbor. Maybe they'd talk to local tech support, who probably forgot to look at our block list that we publish automatically when we block people. Then eventually they would call the help desk and say, I pay a lot of money to go to this university and your network doesn't work. Okay, that would be their complaint. And then hopefully the help desk would look at the block list, but oftentimes they did not. We had no automation for DHCP rogue blocking. So your students, as you know, if you don't have wireless in your dorms, they'll come in, they'll plug their Linksys router in backwards, and they'll start handing out DHCP addresses to all their neighbors, none of which work on your network. And there would be a network outage, and After sending the wiring team to check the wiring, sending the network engineering team to check the switches, they would find the rogue DHCP server, and they would shut the port down. When we put in the network control system, we found a lot of ports that have been shut down for years. Well, again, we started this as a wireless control project, but it quickly, as we began to look at some of the products, we became encouraged and thought we might have a whole network access control project. And so I want to take you through some of our goals, the product and team selection, the design such as it was, and particularly our rollout, where I think the lessons learned are very applicable. We received these executive goals in January 2008. First of all, we needed to be ready with the new system in 6 months because we had to have that online when the new wireless went into the dorms in the fall. Second of all, that old wireless system had to go because of the effect it was having on user satisfaction surveys, and that needed to be gone in a year. So we developed a selection team that I think served us very well. We got the network engineering folks. Our network engineering people are certified Cisco engineers. They're both working on their CCIE. Their manager, the project manager, is a CCNP, so they're dyed-in-the-wool Cisco people. Our network services team, which is kind of our moves, adds, and changes people, and also the folks who are responsible for the physical connections and the wiring. Information security, which is myself and my two analysts. And we didn't bring them in the product selection team, but we involved, and we should have, but we involved them really heavily in training and feedback, which is our client services team, which is Tom's people. And the project would not have been a success without them. They are the folks that deal with the end user tech support. So we brought the executive goals to the product selection team for their reaction. This is one of my favorite Dilbert cartoons. The best part was they didn't exactly spit out their skulls. They kind of choked them down and rolled up their sleeves and went to work. This was our selection process. We had no time for baking off. We could not put in a product, test it, pilot it, and decide if we liked it or not. So we relied on a couple things. We relied on vendor presentations to kind of give us an overview. I like to tell my children the reason why I make the big bucks is because I can read a manual. We have a few other people. Not that the bucks are that big. We have a few other people on the team that could do that as well. So we really dug into the vendor documentation to analyze how the product did its work. And we relied extensively on peer reviews. We spoke with up to four different institutions that had this product in place, and we had detailed operational and technical sessions with people on the phone for 60 to 90 minutes. You guys in the educational community, our peers, are incredibly generous with their time when they're going to help a peer. And in addition to the fact that we learned a lot about the operation and the value of these products, we learned a lot about deploying and installing and operating them, as well as we all got offers back from everyone that we talked to say, look, if you have a problem with it, give us a call. You know, we'll try to help you think it through. So one of the lessons learned here, you know, write this down, is talk to your peers. They're incredibly generous, and they have tremendously valuable experience. Our main considerations in the selection process were, of course, cost. We couldn't have our execs spit out their skulls either if we brought the price tag back. Deployability, we had this very short time frame. We would favor all of the things being equal, things that would help solve our chronic network security problems across the board. But our chief goal with this, since part of the impetus for this was to bring our user satisfaction with the network up, was usability. And I see usability as a security goal, not just a service goal. And the reason for that is this. If your network access control system becomes a monster that threatens people's work or research or teaching or learning or fun, this is what you're going to get. You will get people with pitchforks and torches, and very soon they will find the tools that they need to kill your monster. Then you will not have a monster protecting your network anymore. And so to me, usability is a huge, huge goal of security. You can't just pour cement on your network and walk away. No one can use it. Key factors that we looked at in terms of usability. We kind of favored a captive portal versus those products that would require an agent download. The reason being that agent downloads are more problematic, have more chance of going wrong. Whereas if we could get somebody into a web captive portal and get them to sign in and work the access control from there, we felt that would be more user-friendly. Like all of you, we have lots and lots of guests on our network. Summertime in Malibu, which is where the campus is located, we are covered with kids and executive groups and people doing training sessions for their company. In the first week of May, the university has something called Bible lectureship. If 500 people show up and stay in our dorms, so we have 500 guests at a time sometimes. On our size network, that's pretty big. Some of you from big research universities have 500 guests every day. We also felt that it was important to be able to, so we wanted those people to be able to get access, but we didn't want them to get access to the president's computer. So we wanted them to get easy access, but we wanted to limit the access that they've got. The other thing was we knew we had special guests from time to time, experts that professors would bring in, someone who would come to work with the dean of the law school and so forth, a contractor, somebody who needed more access to the network than we were willing to give an anonymous guest. And so we wanted to make it easy to sponsor these special guests to get full access to the network. And especially, again, harking back to our user satisfaction surveys, we didn't want this device, whatever it was, to limit the bandwidth of the devices under its control. Well, so we had a wish list. Those were our main criteria, but we had a wish list of other things as well that you can see here, and I can drill down into those in the questions, but I have a lot of slides, so let me move on. Cost. So things just really fell into place for us. The cost of the system that we wanted to select was less than the competitors. We not only got a wireless access control replacement system, but we were sure that we could replace the dorm wired nets as well, and maybe even all the wired networks on campus, put them under control of this system. And we were able to purchase licensing sufficient for our entire wide area network. I was looking for a consensus decision from the group, because I knew that if the network engineers or the network services people or the client services people didn't like this system or couldn't work with it or felt that it got in their way, we would not have a good network access control system. It wouldn't work. So I was looking for a consensus decision, and to my surprise, I got it. The selected product looked best on all the key factors and the wish list extras and the cost, and I'm sure that was one reason why we all came to the obvious conclusion. This was our design. We didn't really have time to sit down and do a formal design based on a pilot test, so we used our green field of the new wireless area in the dorms to try out how to deploy this network. And when the dorms were empty in late July, early August, we used, in effect, a green field of the dorm wired networks to see how to deploy it in wired areas. And then we took the lessons we learned and did kind of a template for further rollouts. These were our rollout phases as planned and as actual. We were able to get this into the dorms on the wired and the wireless networks on time before the students came back in August 2008. We wanted to replace the majority of our old wireless access control system on the Cisco heavyweight APs, by October, but we ran into a bug. The iOS, once you started using Radius Mac authentication control, sorry about the jargon, with these access points, they would stop forwarding DHCP broadcasts, which meant that your wireless clients couldn't get an IP address. And so we ended up having to replace the iOS on 350, 360 Cisco Heavyweight APs, and that pushed us back to December of 2008 in completing that phase. We wanted to have all the rest of the wireless areas changed out by summer of 2009. These were primarily Avaya and older Cisco deployments. As we succeeded with this project and the wireless deployment, we got more funding for wireless deployments, and these areas were going to be replaced by Aruba lightweight APs, and so we decided to hold off on getting rid of the old access control system in these areas because we didn't want to deploy the new access control system twice, once on the old systems and once on the Arubas. And so that was delayed until spring of 2010. And I apologize for this green. It stands out beautifully on my screen. But as we got more confidence with this, we decided that we could deploy to all our wired networks as well. And this was accomplished by the end of summer 2009, thanks in large part to Tom's people that had, what did you call that, this summer of 70 projects? 70 days of summer. They had 70 days of summer. They worked really closely with us, and we'll talk a little bit about our lessons from that rollout because I think those are most valuable and relevant to other folks. Our wish list, we got most of it done. We're still waiting on some of these things, and I can answer questions about those later. Let's talk about our rollout. Our keys to finishing the rollout were starting slow because word gets around. If you build with early successes, if you put extra effort in early, then people go, hey, that worked. You know, oh, that's coming to your area? Oh, that wasn't so bad for us. And so we started slow so we could build our early successes. And also we kept it bite-sized as we rolled things out because we really didn't want to overrun our ability to communicate with our users. If you bite off more than you can chew, you have your mouth full and you can't talk with your mouth full. Okay, so you got to talk to your users. That was a real key, and we'll talk about some of the details on that. The green fields were easy, but the retrofits required a lot more work. This is basically our template for retrofitting network access control onto areas that had never had it before, or when we were replacing the old wireless access control system. We did a lot of infrastructure preparation. If what you need to do on your infrastructure as far as your network devices, like your switches and your access points, isn't perfect, if you have somebody who's just like going as fast as they can and keying things in manually without checks, and you've got human error in there, those human errors are going to multiply into troubleshooting and user stories about how they couldn't connect to your network and so forth. And so we really gave a lot of attention to infrastructure preparation. We'll talk about what we did with that in a second, how we put that team together. Then second of all, we did advance notice to leaders and users. This was the big one. Yes, we had vetted the project first with deans and vice presidents, but further communications to our users didn't take a single approach. We evaluated each subnet or building that we were going to do as to who the key people were for us to talk to first. Sometimes they were managers and directors. Sometimes they were the local tech support people that had a great relationship with the folks in that area. Sometimes they were department chairs. We'd explain to those people what we were going to do, what our announcements about the project would look like so that they would be expecting them, and we got them to help spread the word. Sometimes spreading the word was just simply forwarding one of our emails. This was particularly the case when we had a local tech person that had a great relationship with a floor or a building. Sometimes it was us showing up at a department meeting and giving a preview of what this network access control enrollment and operation was going to look like for the end users. Sometimes we'd buttonhole the department chair and say, hey, we'd like to show you what we're going to be, a change that we're going to be bringing to your network. And they're like, oh, yes, it is my network, isn't it? And this is probably one of the first times somebody in IT had spoken to them in that way, and that got us a great hearing. And they saw that the process was easy, and now we had an ally at the highest level in that department that could deal with folks who had fear of change and so forth. So we looked, because we knew our community really well, we looked around, we saw who do we have to talk to in this area to get this message out in an effective way, and we tailored the communication. It was not one size fits all. Yes, we did a standard communication email, and we'll talk about that in a minute. We also found, that we could do a pre-registration period where we had the system in a permissive mode that people could set up their computer under the network access control without being required to do so. And so one of the things that we did is we gave about a two-week run-up to the cutover. And we'd say, you know, next week you'll be able to register your computer. This is how you do it. We encourage you all to get this done before the cutover, which is going to be 2 weeks after that at this time. We'll be present for the cutover so that right from the beginning everybody knows that the IT people would be present with them during the cutover. And so after the end of that first week, we would send another email saying, congratulations, you have registered 58% of the computers in your area with the network control system. Keep it up, you're doing a great job. In the background, with the system giving us information about that network, we went through and did reconnaissance and scrubbing. That sounds odd, but we did. We looked at the network and said, okay, what are the devices that a technician is going to have to register? Printers, static IP devices, HVAC controls. I mean, it's really a bummer on the day of the cutover when your air conditioning goes out, right? So you don't want to have that happen. So we could see from the device what these kinds of things were, and we had an operator that worked with the local tech people to get those things registered so that everything would work. And then at about 3 days, 2 to 3 days before the cutover, we'd send another email and say, hey, congratulations, you guys have got 78% of your computers registered. And don't forget, we're going to be there on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock when the cutover happens or whenever it was that we were going to meet with them. During the cutover, we always provided a walkthrough, and mostly we were not needed. Myself and my then security analyst would put on our nice shirts and ties and walk into the area and just be there. And mostly our experience was someone over there would say, hey, what's this? And before we could get across the room to them, around the cubes and across the room to them, the person in the cube next to them would pop up and go, hey, didn't you get the emails? You just do this and this and this. And we had that experience repeatedly. I'm not making that up. Because we had done this communication, we had allies that were already there. Because it was a user-friendly system, people could get through it and they could help each other. We did have occasionally the device that got missed, like a printer that was off for a few weeks, and things like that. So the neat part about this was, I think, the communication. And in order to put all this together, we needed the right people in the right places. Our leader on the infrastructure was a guy on my team. He's our oldest tenured IT employee, one of the nicest people we ever met. We had the advantage of the fact that he was here for every bit of our network implementation. I think he's going to have his 35th year pretty soon. And he's very thorough and very smart, and he had a good partnership with the network engineering people and the network services techs to do the infrastructure and get it prepared. For operations, training of your local people who are going to use the system, who are going to help their users with the system, and just-in-time response to problems, especially during your cutover, are really critical. Our information security analyst at the time was a guy who could sit on the phone, very service-oriented guy, knew the system really well, and if somebody called up with a problem, he was right there to remind them of what we'd trained them or walk them through the process that we had trained them on for registering devices and so forth, or to troubleshoot and solve an issue if there was one. And that person was partnered with our client services and school tech liaisons folks. And on the communication side, I largely drove that, and it was based upon relationships and knowledge that I had with the local tech support people as well as the line of business people in each area. Well, what were our success indicators? We got nice notes. People that were working on the project got nice notes from the end users. Compliments were passed to our IT leadership and to our vice president. And I went into the CIO's office and asked him how he thought this was going. He says, perfect. I haven't got a single complaint. And, you know how it goes on your campus, that the complaints like travel up to the president and down to the CIO. So we considered that these were great success indicators, and subsequent surveys indicated that our network satisfaction was up in the wireless area, and while we didn't specifically measure access control, we knew at least that it wasn't interfering, otherwise our indicators wouldn't be up. Well, at the end of the year, in summer 2009, we knew considerably more about our network. These are just some aggregate statistics, but bear in mind that we also knew which IP belonged to which person, or every IP on a user network. We had no idea that we had 32,000 ports. It's staggering. I figured that out. That's an average of 78 ports per switch. We have a lot of 48-port switches, and we have some about five or six big 4500s deployed that have, you know, 250, 300, 400 ports on each one. So we were kind of staggered by the knowledge of our network that this gave us. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the good things that came out of that. We'd gotten rid of our obtuse and bottlenecked wireless access control. We'd gotten rid of the fact that anything that plugs in gets full access. We'd gotten rid of the manual blocks. Under the network access control system, if we block somebody based upon an IDS or based upon our network behavioral anomaly detection, that block, instead of going into the router, went into the network access control system, and the next time that person would access a web page, up would come a page. Your computer has been blocked for copyright infringement. Your computer has been blocked for malware. Click here to see what to do about this problem. And then they'd click on the link, and a little screen would come up instructing them how to speak to the help desk, what the key phrase was to tell the help desk, so that the help desk could actually get straight to what their problem was and not put them through a bunch of standard operating procedures and so forth. So the manual blocks were removed. The blocking was automatic, and the users got information about why they were blocked. So, fantastic. Blocking systems. This is really, really important to us, and I suspect it's important to you on your campuses as well. Integrating automatic blocking with our IDS is really saving us. Before we got this fully integrated, here's an example from February 2010. This is one of the packets data that we captured. This is showing a person logging into our campus portal with a totally bogus password that we smacked them for politely. Don't like to embarrass our users. But in addition, that person was working on the campus portal and with a partner site getting transcripts for our alumni. Well, our alumni, a lot of them had student IDs that were their social security number. And so we had to do 17, the registrar had to do 17 information breach disclosures to our alumni because this person's computer got infected with the GOSI Trojan and we didn't have automatic blocking. The reason is That data ended up in Moldova in Russia. Okay, every time that guy hit post, it went to the right place, but it also went to Russia. So we had to do information disclosure. That was a problem. But now what happens when that GOSI Trojan is detected, that system is blocked within seconds. And so this is saving us from having to do disclosures, which cost money directly and indirectly. So we like that. The other thing that used to happen when a computer was blocked, it might be blocked in the dorms for having a spam bot. Then the user would walk it over to the library or the classroom, and it would get blocked on the library's router, it would get blocked on the classroom's router, and in the meantime, it had sent a few hundred or a few thousand more spams, selling the university's reputation, because the blocks were local to the routers. With a full campus network access control system, when that person is blocked in their dorm for getting a spam bot, when they go to the library, they're still blocked. When they go to the classroom, they're still blocked. And they get the web page no matter where they go. If they are on wireless when they get blocked and they plug in on the wired, they're blocked there too. So it's really helped us improve the security of the university by moving the blocks off the routers onto the network access control system. I want to leave some time for questions. You know, when we first started this, the whole Wi-Fi mobile device craze was coming on, and they were also starting to add Wi-Fi into game consoles. And we knew that if we didn't make it easy for end users to register these things with the network access control system, we were going to be in trouble, because already we were getting a little overwhelmed with a request from the CIO to add this executive's iPhone to the wireless control system so he doesn't have to log in all the time and so forth. And when we look at it now, I think we looked at it in spring, and I think we have 1,300 mobile devices, not Windows, not Macintosh, phones that are registered on our network. It's crazy. We would have been overwhelmed. But we did have some problems. We are still working on a couple things, and they're mostly related to the fact that we haven't had time to sit down and test them. Agents, as I said at the beginning, are problematic. They may or may not like to run on the computer that you're on. If they don't run, they might block the computer. So we're in the process of getting ready to set up some dog food testing, or as we like to call it, mad scientist testing, where first the information security and then the information technology people more broadly are part of the group that gets agents, so we can get an idea of what those are like. One of my principles is we don't let somebody who's in IT exclude himself from a control and impose it on other people. So we're going to do the control on ourselves, and just like a mad scientist would test his serum on himself, and see how it works out. We're also working on remote registration. We needed a product software upgrade in order to get that so that students could register remotely before they come to the campus, new students. We needed a software upgrade, but when we put that software upgrade, it bogged down our device, and so we've kind of put that off because we had to buy more hardware this fall. We 30,000 ports and 900 access points it is now are too much for our original hardware buy, and we had to buy more hardware this fall, and that was my fault. We kind of overran our sizing there, and that is also a lesson to learn. Be careful with your sizing. It's really critical. And we have burned a little bit of our goodwill with our technician colleagues this fall because the interface has been a little bit slow for them doing their work. The full cost of the system is still less than what the competitors' wireless network nets only bid, so I use that to justify my foolishness. Well, overall, it was a really successful rollout. I'd like to hear what your questions are, make anything more clear or anything that's specific to your campus.
You may have a little further upstream.
Okay, that's a really good question. So the question that's being asked is, where is the NAC operating? Is it on every port, or is it working upstream? So the way that this particular solution works is it works with SNMP traps and radius, which your wired switches and your wireless access points will all send. And so it actually operates on the users at the port level and at the radio level, which means, for example, on wireless access points, we were always concerned, okay, so the guy connects to the wireless access point. If we block him at the switch where that access point connects, won't everybody else on that radio get infected? And what ends up happening with the way that this works is when the access point sends the Radius MAC trap down to the device tells the access point what VLAN to put that person on, and they'll end up either on production or guest or registration or quarantine VLANs. I hope that answers your question. There was another question here. You know what? I'd like to not put that on the recording. I'll be happy to ask answer that afterwards, and there's a lot of good systems out there. So the question is, by the way, the last question was what system did you pick, and I declined to answer that. This question is, how many IPs can a user have? Is that a fair way to answer that question? For example, you have your laptop, your Nintendo DS, you have your phone, your iPhone, your iPad, your Android, whatever that is. The way the system, this particular system, is licensed is that each user can have up to 10 IPs by default. And we do operate on public IPs strictly for user networks. We have 65,535 of them. As you know, we only have 7,700 users, students, about 8,500, 10,000 total, and so we're not going to run out. So, question. Yes, it is IPv6 compatible. However, we are IPv6 hostile, and you know that that's not entirely effective because of tunneling and things like that. But currently, we're trying to keep IPv6. We certainly don't route it on our network, but it is IPv6 compatible. Question in the back. So the question is, did the mix of access points present any specific challenges? Yes. And in fact, the other thing that you have to keep in mind is we also have Xeris access points. They look like flying saucers, about 2 feet across. They have 8 radios in them. And that's a brand new product in the industry that was chosen because of the construction in some of our dorms. We also had older Avaya, Lucent access points. We also had really old Cisco heavyweight access points that weren't supported. So the product kind of has two modes in dealing with access points. One is where it fully integrates with the system, takes the radius MAC traps, and then knows how to command the system back, SSHs or telnets into the system, or gives a radius response to put the person on the right VLAN. There are other access points that don't have that level of integration, and they go under the lying DHCP DNS server type of control, which is not as good. But basically, you can integrate with that system. You can integrate any type of device, because what it will do is it will give a non-routable IP address to them by DHCP and lie to them about who their DNS resolutions are in order to do the access control in that kind of a situation. It's much better if it's integrated where you actually separate the VLANs, but there is a function on that, and I think some other kinds of network access control systems to control non-standard devices. Let me get this gentleman here. Any challenges with NATed VMs on the endpoints? No, not with NATed VMs. although it does show a different DHCP fingerprinting signature, which is something we didn't talk about. The system tries to identify the operating system by its DHCP fingerprint, and if you've got Windows Vista running in a VM on a Mac, the system will alert you, hey, this Mac address is changing operating system fingerprints. This is either a VM or somebody's spoofing a Mac address. The problem comes with bridged VMs, where where the VM is generating its own MAC address to the network in addition to the host. The guest VM is generating a different MAC address to the network in addition to the host. And the behavior that everyone will experience in that case is that their system will be able to talk for a few seconds, and then it won't be able to talk. You'll start to register the VM, and then you'll be back on the production network, and your registration won't go through. And so what we have done is we've done a help desk sheet for that, as well as hubs, right? So this is the peer pressure against hubs, okay? If you're on a hub and everything's working nice and whatnot, and somebody comes up and plugs their unregistered computer into the hub, the port that hub is connected to upstream will see, oh, somebody I don't know, let me switch that port into the registration VLAN. The entire hub will be in the registration VLAN. Everybody will be asked to register again. Of course, it won't work because client already registered and so forth. And so we do have those gotchas, yes. There was another question in the way back. Yes, sir.
How does the user registration
work? I probably should have put up some slides about that, but I was trying to be vendor agnostic. I guess I could have blurred things out. But basically what happens is they put their computer on the radio or on the port, and the system decides that they're unknown based on their MAC address and puts the port into a registration VLAN. At that point, they get a very short DHCP lease of less than 2 minutes, and they're given a DNS server that lies like a dog. Oh, did you want to go to CNN? Funny enough, I'm CNN. Send your packets to me. And so they'll open their CNN web page, and it will say, Waves Connect Computer Registration. That's how we branded it internally, because we're the Pepperdine Waves, right? So Waves Connect Computer Registration, please log in. And they get a choice of, are they a student, first of all? Are they a faculty or staff? Do they want to be an anonymous guest with limited access? Would they like to be a sponsored guest where their sponsor has given them an ID or password, or are they trying to register a game, console, or DVR? And so they choose on that web page, and then they follow through. The first thing that happens to them when they make their choice is, are newly revised, readable, and small, concise, acceptable use policy comes up, and they have to agree to that. Once they agree to that, then they can put their registration information in. We do ask that the anonymous guests give us their true name, which doesn't work very well with the kids that come for camps, their local access number, and their reason for visiting the campus. And we have used that kind of information to help people that have been having network trouble. So, or they log in as a faculty, staff, or student through our enterprise authentication system. It's LDAP on the back end. Basically, that's how it works. Did you have a quick follow-up on that? Yes? No? Okay. This gentleman back here, and then this gentleman in the front. Okay, so the question is, how does this work with non-browser devices like game consoles and DVR, wireless parking ticket meters, and so forth? What you do is you get onto a registered computer, you use the product's documentation to obtain its MAC address, and you go to the game console and DVR registration page, you input the MAC address or the IP address of that device. Onto that page, you enter your university network ID and password, and the device is registered then to you. You have the ability to kind of open that to any kind of device, or you have the ability to limit it to known game console Mac prefixes, what we find is that the vendor doesn't do a 100% job of keeping up with the new Mac prefixes that come out on non-browser devices. And so we have to keep our local tech support people for those kinds of folks appraised of what to do when one of their users finds this problem where they can't register a non-browser device because its MAC address prefix isn't in the system. Excuse me. And then they will report to us the MAC prefix. We'll go ahead and adjust it in the system and then send a note out to the user that they should try again. Okay, how do we manage voice over IP and also peer-to-peer VoIP hardware, let's say? We're using Cisco voice over IP is what we're rolling out. Fortunately, the system knows how to deal with that very well. Again, we turn to when our CIO brought that out of his back pocket and said, we're doing VoIP. We immediately ran off to our peers in higher education and said, do you have VoIP on this thing? And sure enough, we found out that what the system can do is it can understand what the voice VLAN is and allow for the VoIP phones to be plugged in, recognize their MAC. We preload their MAC addresses, so when we get a load of VoIP phones from the vendor, we preload their MAC addresses into the system. They're recognized as VoIP phones when they're plugged in. The system knows about their voice VLAN and knows not to change that voice VLAN around, put it into production, or do some crazy stuff like that. And one more important thing about VoIP, because the system won't mess with the VoIP VLAN, and you have a computer plugged into a VoIP phone, a Cisco VoIP phone, when that computer is detected as having a spam bot or something, the system knows to not bring that port down. That's a problem because the user's computer is now in the registration VLAN, but it hasn't gotten a signal by the link going down and then up that it's on a new network. And so those people do get a confusing experience if they're blocked. Also, our students that get the message, hey, if you want to see these pictures, you have to install this codec, and they click. That usually gives them a DNS changer Trojan, and since the display of the warning page is based upon using our DNS server in the system, and they're trying to use a DNS server in the Ukraine that doesn't know about our campus, they don't get the display of that page. So we do have a couple people, the people that are plugged into VoIP phones and the people that are plugged into, that get DNS changer Trojans, that don't get the notice. And we're actually working on that. We're trying to find the configuration that will allow us to send an email to those people so that when they go to an alternate computing device, they can read their mail and say, oh, that's why my computer isn't working. As far as specialized VoIP hardware, soft phones and things like that usually use the computer's MAC address, and so they're not a problem. But if somebody has a Vonage, is usually typical what it is. They bought a Vonage phone, they brought it to campus, their technical support person has to register that for them. We don't have self-registration for those yet. All right, well, I think it's after time. No, it's not. We still have a couple minutes. It's time, so I'll be up here with the microphone off if you want to talk until the next presenter kicks us out. And thank you all for coming.